And welcome, overtimers. It is March 21st, 2020, at the time of this taping. Wonder what this is going to sound like 5 years from now. 10 confirmed COVID-19 cases in St. Louis County. That's 73 overall in the state. St. Louis did have its first casualty last night. Fits the profile. 60 plus, had health issues. If you are not that profile, your job, nay, your obligation, is to do all the precaution you can for you and your others. And F those spring breaker idiots that found the news last week. Today, starting at 5 o'clock, 12.6 million people in Illinois are going to be banned from leaving their homes through April 7th for non-essential business. 585 people have tested positive. That's up 46 from the week before. And there have been five confirmed deaths. In the state of Missouri, or at least in St. Louis, it sounds like we're going to get that same ban on Sunday. Staying local, AMC theaters closed for 6 to 12 weeks. Goodwill going to open up an hour later so they can clean a little bit more. T-Mobile closing 80% of its stores, the remaining 20% on reduced schedules. Here's some thoughts, some predictions maybe, on what we can expect to go away. Paying your bill in person, not going to happen anymore. Start setting up those bills online. Hand-to-hand in general, going to go away. Other things like getting your gas, going into the post office, sitting on Santa's lap, going away. Days off work and school, not anymore. Get a good laptop for your birthday. And things that I just can't imagine, but they'll look different. Real estate, buying a car, going to sporting events and concerts. Personal services like buying a diamond, going in the diamond store, getting your hair cut, probably going to shift over to an appointment-only scenario. Nationally, Italy, the size of Arizona, 3,405 have died from COVID-19. Wall Street, worst week since 2008. If you are over 50, you probably had your retirement pushed back a little bit. Trump, in all his wisdom, says that on April 6th, every person who has done their taxes in 2018, even if they're married, will individually receive checks for anywhere from $600 to $1,200. This is going to go off without a hitch. On a positive note, driving into work this morning, I've lived in my house for 13 plus years, and I have never seen as many people out and about walking. So you got that. More positive news. Today's episode, Jackie Smith, the Missouri treasurer. That is Jackie Smith. We talk about growing up in a small southern town, how he got the opportunity. This is a good story about how he got the opportunity to actually make an NFL roster, because when he was done, he was the best tight end to have ever played the game. We start the episode off talking about the America Wall, the Vietnam Memorial replica that is in Perryville. Now, we did this episode before all this nonsense with Corona came about, but I found it very interesting. I found it something that I can't believe nobody else had done it. You're going to hear how it is exactly like the monument in Washington. And if you can't get down to D.C., got to check out the wall in Perryville. Even if you can get down to D.C., probably the atmosphere in Perryville is even better. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get it going. Jackie Smith.
Go to overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
When you were inducted into the Hall of Fame, you actually sang the national anthem. So I was wondering if maybe starting this podcast off with your rendition of the national anthem would be a good place to start.
Oh, into this, really?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming. And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
That was excellent. I'd do that every day if I could sing like that.
No.
All right, the Missouri National Veterans Memorial is what we're going to start talking about. How did you get attached to this project in Perryville?
It was a friend of mine I had in Perryville for a long time. His name was Ed Robinson, and I've known him for a long time. He has a great company down there, sells rocks all over the country. And I never really knew he had a brother, but because they had a kind of a misunderstanding, and this has been almost 10 years, I got introduced to his brother, and his brother, he wanted to show me what they were doing, and that's when I got introduced to this memorial that they're building down there. And so they asked me, his brother Ed asked me, Frank, rather, asked me if I'd like to be in part of the program and help him get the thing promoted. And I said, you know, it was nothing else I could do better with my time than to do this after they told me about it and introduced me to the whole deal and some of the people involved. But the interesting story behind it, I guess, that really sort of just really took me in was the fact that the land down there was donated for the project, and it was donated by a guy who was in the Vietnam War and wanted to do something to remember his friends that were killed in that battle. And so he donated 47 acres to build something on, and at the same time donated $2.5 million to put up an exact replica of the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C., and it's exact in every detail, even for the forest where the granite came from in South Africa. And so after I heard that story, I met Jim Edelman, who was the guy that gave the land and the money for the wall. I really was impressed with his sincerity and his sincereness about doing this. He drives a beat-up pickup truck. His wife is a cleaning lady. And it's just a wonderful story of a dedication and a big heart when it comes to doing something like this. So I felt it was a good way to spend my time and to try and help out as I could. And so that's where I've been here for 2.5 years now, getting people introduced to the thing, introduced to the people I know and to the radio stations, TV stations, and whatever.
And so that people understand, it is such like the actual wall that they call it the sister wall.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. In fact, the guy who runs the wall up in Washington, D.C. came down and was able to give it a close inspection and, you know, vouch for the fact that everything was exactly the same. So there's no doubt about that now. But, yeah, so and it has a stark, view there, but it's out in the middle of what used to be a cornfield, and it gives it really a nice backdrop to, instead of buildings like they have in Washington, D.C., we've got cornfields behind it and farm silos, and so it's a completely different atmosphere, and gives us it's a place where you can relax and really enjoy and come to grips with what these men and women did to keep us safe and free and doing things we're doing today.
It's so intricate that the way they've placed the wall, actually how the sun rises and sets is exactly how it rises and sets in D.C.
That's right.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy, but you know, I think you have to be a little bit crazy to do what we're doing sometimes, but especially Jim. This was just something strong to Jim, and I think he he bears a lot of people should get to know him and what he's about as much as they can if they ever have the opportunity. He's quite a guy. He won't talk much. In fact, he's suffering from PTSD, and it has its effect on him. But he is one wonderful, sincere guy, and as is all the others that are involved in this project. Some of them doing it for nothing, and obviously, the city is it's a big involvement with the city and people within the city, and with Frank Robinson and his organization. And he's lending his a lot of his company employees there to the effort. Others around the community are, but we've got the building up. I mean, we got the buildings are up. We got two buildings up along with the wall on the 47 acres. And if you go into the buildings there, you'll see Nancy will be in there to see you along with several volunteers. Which is something that we really like to mention is the fact that so many of the volunteers come there to help and do any way they can. And most volunteers are retired Army or Navy or of one of the services anyway. And so it really has become a team effort down there, so to speak, with that town, that city, take a great deal of pride in having this thing in their vicinity. And now, at the beginning now, we're trying to get the word out, and we are getting the word out to surrounding areas. We'd like to, at least I'd like to make it, this to be a Missouri project. It's in the heartland of the United States, which is right here in Missouri. And to have this thing built and produced by people in this area in Missouri. And in Illinois, maybe, but I just think it would be a great thing to do. It'd be a great feather and source of pride for all the men and women of Missouri.
And unfortunately, about 60,000 names are on the wall.
Yeah, they're 58,200 something. Yeah, and they change every now and then. They add one to it or whatever when they can identify with someone, and they always add it, and they're. And I don't know if anybody knows how it's and what arrangement the names are on, but if you're familiar with the wall, it's a big. It fades into the ground on each side. It's 11 feet high in the middle, and then it goes out both ways and goes into the ground. And on the right-hand column, which is the highest one, and in the middle, right where the walls meet, the first. On the top of that long, tall panel is the first recorded people and gentlemen or ladies killed in the civil and the Vietnam War, and then it goes down and then back up on the next one, and in the order that the lives were lost, and it goes down into the ground, and you know, and then it back up again into the big column on the left. I mean, the big plate on the left, and it goes to the bottom of that is the last name of the person killed in the war. So you find the names just by going to the at the building that we have there in the museum. Given the name, and we have a computer there or a wall, really it can be utilized by the public to go and find their name. By putting the name in, it tells you the line that they were on, which is they have dots every five lines, and so they give you the dot, the line that it was on, and the panel that it was on, and that's really how people find their name.
Did you unfortunately lose some friends in the war?
I have some friends that I went to college with that were lost, and I think that I'm sure most people my age have, and probably some youngers, that they haven't been educated on that yet. But, yeah, I have some friends that were there.
So I have seen the wall in D.C. Very inspiring, I know, if that's the right word. But you definitely get a chance to just understand the history of it and all those people that are on the wall. I have not seen the one in Perryville. I absolutely am planning on going down there soon. I love the idea of it sitting by a space where you're not in the middle of all the hubbub that the wall is in Washington.
Right. Well, that's if any of the listeners have never been to the wall in Washington D.C., you should go to the one in Perryville. It's a humbling and a really almost an emotional experience, and it is for some people. In fact, some guys and gals, you know, can't even walk down to it because it means that there's someone that they lost or it means so much to them or affects them so much emotionally. But to see all those names simply stated on a wall like that, it's very compelling. So that's it's worth the trip down there just to understand that and get that appreciation for what happened.
So the website is americaswall.com.
Right.
And that directs you to the government site, americaswall.com. And there's a couple things about the website that struck me. One was the suggestion for this place to be where schools should go on field trips. As many times as I went to the freaking Arch, I would think this would be something everybody should at least once on a field trip go down and see.
Yeah, we've had several that have done that and would encourage more because it really is. And we have plenty of volunteers there that can handle that type of thing and have it handle a school bus load and put four or five of them can go out. But they've become some of our volunteers, a lot of them retired military, have learned a lot about the wall. There are some interesting things about it and the history of how it was built and what the shape means and all that all the visitors find interesting that our volunteers can share with them.
The other thing that I saw on the website is there's a place called Testimonials.
Yep.
That's not about the wall, but it's about the stories from the individuals who were in the war, which I found interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, and we have at the wall in Washington, D.C., they collect a lot of those and try to catalog as much as they can and store them. We have a lot of people that leave items out there, shoes or some type of remembrance at the wall, and we collect those, and we will have a place for those in the museum that we're putting together there.
What are the future plans?
Well, we have right now. we're having a drive or an effort to collect funds to build the walkthrough gardens that are there. We have that acreage there that Jim Edelman donated, so we have like 45 acres there that we got the building, the visitor center. Large parking lot there. Then you have the museum right adjacent to it, and then behind that you have the field, and at the end of that little field is the wall, and it's a nice walkway out there to it. It's no big deal out there at all to get to it, but in between and behind the building and in front of the wall, we have a walkthrough gardens that are planned there, some statues that are going to be there. We have some tanks and other vehicles that have been donated, and so we're trying to get in a position to get all that done, and that's what we encourage people to that have an interest in it, because we are trying to still raise funds, and that it's not a lot of people come down there and see that, and it's nice just to see that, but to build the whole complex to fruition is really going to be quite a feat, and it takes a few bucks to do that, but it's really going to be such a tribute to the fighting men and women that were lost, and also really a source of pride and education for anybody who visits it. And anybody who goes to our website at mnvmfund.org, or you can go to americaswall.com. When you get you there too, then you can see what we have planned. and what's going to be in there. And I keep thinking about those types of monuments being out there in the little coves areas that we're going to have, and it be in the solitude of the countryside there, and instead of the one that they have in Washington, D.C. is sort of noisy with the traffic around it and all the other activity that takes place in the surrounding exhibits. But this is going to be unique and really such a tribute to the men and women that were lost in that war and all, because we're in all the rest of the wars. We have tributes up there for all of them, or in the process of doing that. We have one wall, adjacent wall, another wall adjacent to our building that depicts all of the battles that the United States has been in, and then you have all of them are really well depicted in with some with tanks and military and any other information that we could put up there that depicts those particular conflicts. And you can get some earphones at the center there, and you can go out and walk through and get a complete education on all the conflicts that the United States has been involved in. And so so we're still building, and then we'll have an adjacent museum that we're in the process of building now, collecting items for that. So anyway, we're in the process of making this as good as we can make it, and all in a tribute to our military.
And not to put you on the spot, but I would imagine you've seen some pretty touching moments down there.
Yeah, we have. We've seen quite a few. We had Joe Buck down, his camera crew down there. Then we did see some interesting things. We've had several gatherings down there. The governor's been down there several times, and we've had quite a few fundraisers down there to get the thing off of the ground. But you do see a lot of individuals that come down. A couple of guys come down there and put out some memorabilia that they have, and they just sit there for quite a while. And so you see all sorts of tributes and all the emotional involvement that so many people, men and women, have with that wall, and by the fact that all those names are right there in front of you, and you have to come to grips with that. And it's not a funny feeling, but it's a humbling feeling, I'll have to say, if anyone's never been to the wall.
Before we move on, Jim Edelman, again, let's just talk. There's so many people involved with this project that Jim probably would be the first one to tell you he didn't do this on his own. But if you take into consideration, so he was in the war. The way the story reads is he vowed if he got home that he would do something about remembering his friends. Lord knows I have not remembered or did what I told people I was going to do 30 years ago. But it's still something he's knowing about. It's still something he wants to do. And now the son of a gun got it done.
Well, that's the unusual thing. It's been 50 years.
50 years.
50 years, but he didn't. But he never relented. I mean, he never did change his mind on that at all. He was always determined. Jim is an interesting guy in that he drives that pickup truck that I told you about that's beat up, and he also, but he so he'll fool you. But he's done well in the stock market, and he's made some interesting buys, and so that's really what happened with him. But he's really a very unassuming guy, and one of my favorite people, and I'm sure he'll find his way into the hearts of a lot of people when we get this wall finished.
And his wife Charlene playing a part?
Oh yeah, she takes care of him. That's a big thing, and she's always around and always supportive of him. And I go down there all the time, and she's always She's always very cheerful and anxious to give everybody a hug, and she's obviously very proud of what's going on and very much involved.
Talked about the setting in Perryville, small town USA. You were born in a small town.
Right. Yeah, born in Kentwood, not born in Kentwood, but in Columbia, Mississippi. But we spent our time as a kid in Kentwood, Louisiana. We graduated from there with a class of 35, I think. So we were a small school.
What'd your mom and dad do?
My mom was a housewife. My dad was a machinist.
Worked with his hands.
Yeah, buddy, he could do that. And he was a hardworking guy, and he passed at an early age back smoking a damn pipe. And it was the thing back then. People didn't really know that it was that bad for you, but he just wouldn't relent on smoking that pipe, and it got him. He was only 50 years of age.
Any brothers or sisters?
Sure. I got two brothers and a sister. One of my brothers is gone. He's younger. But my other brother lives down in Louisiana on Lake Bruin. And my sister lives in Waterloo, Illinois.
Who cooks the best jambalaya in the family?
Well, I don't know if any of them want to try to do that anymore. Jambalaya, maybe not. We don't cook. We never have cooked much jambalaya. But we always lean toward making gumbo, and so it's always a fight on who, I guess, or not a fight, but a challenge on who makes the best gumbo. But you know, so many people make it so many different ways that any way they make it is good for me. I just ate some last night, as a matter of fact, and so.
What's your secret spice?
Oh, there's no secret spice. There's a secret. There's nothing's a secret in it. It's just the methods. You either accept the method that it's just the methods that people do it with. On how much, really, the main ingredient is the roux, the original part of the thing to start it off with is the roux, and how that's applied, made, and administered. So and it could be many variations of it, and they still call the stuff gumbo, but. But it's fun to do. It takes a while to do it if you do it right, you have to. That's if you get just to do the roux, it's a good six pack. You know, that's all I can say.
So small high school, yeah. Didn't play a lot of football because you were hurt, but you definitely excelled in track.
Yeah, that's right. My sophomore year I didn't play. I don't think I even went out. And then in the junior year I played. But I was out for football. But I never played. I got into the last game of the year, and then my senior year I played four games and got hurt and out. So that was my football career in high school. But I got to college to run track, and they were nice enough to say, if you'll just go out for football and don't quit, then we can give you a full scholarship. So that happened to be my best deal. So I said, well, why not? So that's what I did.
How important was Jack Rockwell?
Jack Rockwell, well, he was. I think he was in the scouting deal that came to Northwestern to see me run track, and then as far as I know, that I was drafted strictly on my track background. Certainly not on my football background. That was nothing to see there, but I could run pretty well, and so they said, well, maybe if he can run, maybe he can do something. And so I was going to be an outside receiver, and so they said, well, you're big enough that we can keep you in case Taz Anderson gets hurt at tight end, you can back him up.
I think we now refer to him as Wally Pipp. Huh? Remember how Wally Pipp got hurt and Lou Gehrig got to play in all those games?
Yeah.
I think Taz Anderson is our version of Wally Pipp.
Maybe so, yeah, but that's how I got in. He got hurt in against a game against Philadelphia, and so I got in. And it's so it's you know, and you have to have breaks like that. Not it was such a good break for Taz, I guess, but for what for being able to play, you have to have breaks like that and have you be at the right place at the right time. And so many players, no matter how good they are, just never had that up, never had that chance or had that break, and they really either faded away or lost faith in trying to play, and never did get to be able to do what they could do. So I was very lucky to be able to have that opportunity to play and have the coaching that I did at the time.
So we're with the Cardinals, 1963-ish?
That was my year, yeah, my first year.
Are we married yet?
Yeah, we are.
And the story that I like, pronounced correctly, it's Jerry, right?
Yeah.
The story that I read that I thought was kind of cute, especially if you consider you know, the time, a lot of what was lore was the guys driving around in cars to impress the girls. But what I read was your future wife had herself some pretty interesting cars.
Yeah. Yeah. She had a sled. I mean, she had a, it was a, I think it was a 58, 58, 60, maybe it was a 60. Yeah. I think it was 60 Mercury, red Mercury convertible. And so, yeah, so I said, yeah, so anyway, I got in, that's when I'd just gotten into college. And so, you know, I knew everything and I was bulletproof, plumb invisible because I was a college guy. And so I had enough courage to ask her. So.
And you grew up 5 miles apart but didn't know each other until college?
Not, I knew who she was, but I, you know, I'm just a little farm guy down there. And she was a big shot up there and 5 miles away, so I wasn't gonna attempt that. So, but when I got my courage up, I fooled her.
And she moves with you to St. Louis?
Oh yeah. We were married.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we were married.
So now you get drafted in the 10th round. Lure is that you got drafted because and I believe the story to be true, by the way, if you look at how the Cardinals drafted while they were here. But you got picked in the 10th round because there wasn't anybody left on their board. Have you heard that story before?
No, but they all I know is that when I got, and they told me after I retired, they said that they were trying to pick out who to, they were about to lose the 10th round. And they said, oh, hell, just take that red-headed kid from Louisiana. And that's really my qualifications being red-headed, I guess, so.
So who is Frank Polesfoot?
Fran Polesfoot. Yeah, Fran Polesfoot was the coach there at the time. He was our end coach, and he knew that I could run, and so I was really drafted and really held from being cut by Fran Polesfoot because Wally Lim, the coach at the time, really wanted to. Putting me aside to find somebody else to put into a tight end position to back up Taz Anderson, and so, but Coach Polesfoot prevailed, and I got to stick around.
So you're big, you're fast, you can catch, but if you don't put your fingers in the ground, you're not going to play. So you really went after it when it came to blocking.
Well, I tried to. I probably wasn't the best blocker in the world, but I learned the techniques of trying to use my ability I had to move them around a little bit, and so finally got enough to do the job. And we at that time tight ends had to play in tight all the time, and now you have like five tight ends. Four or five tight ends, and they all are just big outside receivers is what they are because you can split out 10 yards and have a guy in front of you about 10 yards away. And I would love to have had that situation of being split out 10 yards and with no linebacker trying to knock your head off and to be able to see that defensive back out there and him covering man for man, and that would be like, as my old buddy in Louisiana used to say, like a bird nest on the ground. I'd be lucky.
You played 121 straight games, and half of those were on what you could call green concrete. This was not when AstroTurf was fun to play on.
That's true. Well, yeah, we played on the first AstroTurf we had in St. Louis with, I think it was the first one, unless it was Houston. I think Houston may have had it, and that's where we had played on there. And I think all of a sudden they got the bright idea that it would be great to put it in Busch Stadium. And it was just a mess. I don't even want to get into all the details of why it was a mess, but it was something we had to play on at the time, and so we were sort of, I guess, part of the transitioning from turf to artificial turf. But it was not a fun thing, and there were a lot of injuries from that. I'm sure a lot of people was burned because of the chemicals they put on there. To keep the stuff thawed out in cold weather. So it was we went through that and played on some pretty bad fields, including some ones that were trying some experiments by putting heating coils in the ground, and they did that in Green Bay, and it was like somebody plowed the field or something. But it was But we went through that transition period of time there, and then playing, obviously, on Busch Stadium, where there was nothing there. I remember there's some pictures that have been circulating in Cardinal history, football history, a long time when we played in the game against the New York Giants when Dwight Tittle was playing, and we finished warming up, went inside, and this is when we were playing in the old Busch Stadium, so it was a just a baseball field and flat as it can be, obviously.
What was that like?
And so it was a mess. They got the ball the first time. Tittle was smart enough to pass the ball real quick before everybody got bogged down. But before long, all the uniforms looked the same, and there were no lines on the field, and water was everywhere, and it was a mess. We just get at the halftime. We got into the shower with our uniforms on just to get the mud off, because you try to run a pass pattern and go 10 yards and feel like you've run a mile or two.
When I feel or I think back about the Cardinals, I go back to the Cardiac Cardinals, 74-75. What was that like to be a part of that?
Well, that was great because we had Coryell and Jim Hannifin and those guys in as far as my coaches were concerned. But they were great, and Coryell was an innovator. He really got us cranked up and going, and modified our offense so we took to be able to take advantage of some of the abilities that we had at receiving and blocking and throwing the ball. So we became known really mainly as a passing team, but offensively oriented. But that whole era was there. I had the opportunity to go through two. I think they came in when I was in my, I guess, in my about my ninth year or tenth year or something. I don't know about that time. And then so I had one group of coaches and whatever from the first part of my career, and the last life we have all Hannifin and Coryell and that whole crew that changed things up and made us a more effective offense, and was a lot of fun.
I think the 75 team still holds the record for fewest sacks allowed.
Yeah, I think that they do. And
you were part of that.
Sometimes they included me, but I wasn't have part of that. But for the most part, that was the lineman that did that. But they did. They were a great group, and Hannifin and all the guys get together that are still around here and talk about it all the time. But I'll probably be seeing him tomorrow or the next day.
What kind of a leader was Jim Hart?
Jim was a good leader. He was a you lead sometimes by your commitment and the way you play, and I think that Jim was not that much of a vocal a leader, but he really did it by example, and that which is the best kind.
You ever see the movie North Dallas 40?
No.
You should check it out. It's based on 1970s football, mm-hmm. and it's regarded as one of the more real football movies. Nick Nolte's in it. It was based on a book that was published in the late 70s. I'd be curious to, I'll come back to you on that one. I'll call you back in a couple of weeks, and you can tell me if you've seen
it. Okay, well.
So you're sharing the Busch Stadium with the Cardinals. Did you get along with any Cardinals? Have any good Cardinal friends?
Yeah, baseball?
Yeah.
Well, we did at the time. I got to know Joe Cunningham and Don Blessingame and some of those guys. And I know Ozzy, of course, and several other guys there. So get to know them. And then we got to know, obviously, a lot of the blues players, too, since then. But, yeah, we never did get to see a lot of the baseball players, although we dressed, right down the hall from them as far as playing. But we never did have use of the facility at the same time, really, except in certain parts of the year.
You were in the ninth ever Monday Night Football game. Was it a big deal at the time that you played, or was that a couple years down the road? Do you remember that?
Yeah, sure, I know.
Was it a big deal?
Well, yeah, it was a weird deal that because of the way we did it, but I think it was in Chicago that we played against Chicago for some reason. I remember that, but I don't know. Maybe I don't remember that right, but but I know that you could feel the changes coming, and that TV started being something to be considered in scheduling and putting that together every year.
Should Don Coryell be in the Hall of Fame?
I think so. I think he was an innovator as far as the type of offense he had, and the offense worked for quite a while. And now they've modified, and it's become all passing practically. But yeah, he'd have to be considered to get into the Hall of Fame for sure. I hope he gets in there still trying, I think.
So in 77, you retire. You got more receptions, yards, and touchdowns than any tight end in history, and you're thinking you're pretty much done, but you're sitting on your couch, and Tom Landry gives you a call, which, by the way, has to be a huge compliment, because towards the end of your career, you weren't on the field as much as you wanted. They're the Super Bowl champions, and he calls you up and says, "We need you." What was that like?
Well, he called me up when I was standing in a little restaurant I had, and he said you had a phone call, and I went to the phone, and he said, "Jackie, this is Coach Landry." I said, "Sure." I hung the phone up and went back. I thought somebody was messing with me, so I went back to eating, and he called back and was laughing and just said, "Well, like for you to come down." And I said, "Coach, well, I've had this problem with my neck as far as being hurt, and the Cardinals asked me to come back, and then they said I failed the physical." So he said, "Well, just come on down, and we'll figure that out." Well, I went down, and I went to go get a physical, and to the doctor they had in an adjoining town, a little town, outside of Dallas. So we went down there, and the doctor, he was in a hurry to get out of the office so he could take some cattle to the market. I had a truckload to go take them to the auction, and so I got a cursory physical, and he said, "You look fine to me," and then that was it. So I was in. So I never will forget that. I said, "No matter." So these guys didn't. Evidently, the Dallas guys were playing on just a really holding their breath that they wouldn't get hurt, because it looks like the coach. I mean, it looks like the doctor down there didn't give them a very good examination beforehand.
So you're 38 years old and you still run a 4.6. What is that?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
How do I do
that? How do you stay in shape? You're 38 years old and you're still running a 4.6.
Well,
Jackie, I think my best time ever was like a full second, at least more than that. And that was when I was 18.
I've always been lucky to win the running. That's what got me into the league, is to be able to run. And so I could run a long time, and I could run faster than a lot of guys my size. And so that was my big asset there, and that certainly and nothing I can brag about. It's just the way that it is. I had good legs, and I had a good parents that give me those legs. But I had, in fact, about 6 months ago, I went to New Orleans to have a physical, and they took like 20 x-rays of my legs because it was an NFL thing that they did for us. But they looked at my legs and they went, he said, come in, let me go over the x-rays with you. And he went just clicking right through them and said, you look like you've never played a down of football.
That's crazy.
And it's not that I'm tough or anything. It means that.
Of course you're tough.
It has to do with who mom and dad were. It's heredity has to. That's what that comes from. So now we got to do your part. I got to do my part just to keep it in shape. And I've tried to do that. In fact, as we speak here, I just came down from here from working out. And so I know that that's a necessary thing for me. At my advanced age of 80, I
just turned 80 a couple days ago.
Yeah, don't tell me that. I just it's funny how I didn't even figure it. I didn't even acknowledge it until all of a sudden it's here. And I said, wait a minute, that's not a 7 anymore. That's a of any kind, but it's a 8. But anyway, it's better than second choice.
In that movie, that North Dallas 40 movie I was talking about, they depict in the movie a lot of the players having to take shots for pain and so they can get out there and play.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of that going on?
Not that I know of, really.
Gotcha.
It just didn't make any sense to do that. Now, I did it, though. I tried to take it for a strained ankle I had one time. I tried to get it injected to numb the pain because But it wore off. But as soon as they put it in there, I said, this is stupid. So you can't, but it didn't match the pain at all. I'm sure there's some injuries that do mask, shots will mask the pain. But I don't remember anybody doing anything like that. It was just foolhardy and really, it was just a chance of getting hurt and even worse, really.
You said on multiple occasions that every time you got tackled, you felt defeated. I can't believe that's the case. I mean, what happens if you whip off a 40-yarder and they push you out of bounds? You still felt defeated?
Well, I'm not so defeated. I'm just disappointed that I just wanted to go all the way down. That's all. And I think that was the same feeling anybody would have. But the only time I got felt any different about it, if somebody was trying to hurt you or trying to do something that wasn't quite correct and nice, then I got upset about that. But other than that, I wasn't mad. I was always just kind of mad at myself for not, because I always thought I could do better or should have done better when it comes to running.
Do you remember that touchdown pass you caught against the Falcons to get the Cowboys in the Super Bowl?
Oh, yeah, I do remember. I'll be darned. Yeah, I do that. Yeah. In fact,
So we get to the Super Bowl. It's in the third quarter. You get crossed up with Roger Staubach. Everybody knows about it. This is what I like to ask. Hopefully, some good came from that. When you look back at it now, is it something where you're like, yeah, that moment sucked, but it helped other things be better?
Not really. It was a... the only thing about it is that nobody ever, I can't explain that to anybody about what happened. I know what happened. It wasn't, it was just, I know what happened on all that, but it doesn't make any difference. It happened. But I don't think about it anymore, quite frankly.
1994, you're in the Hall of Fame. Took a while to get there, but what did it feel like when you got the call?
Interesting thing on that. It was the day that they were supposed to make the announcement. And so, coincidentally, that was the same day that my son-in-law was being buried. He died prematurely, died with a heart with a heart attack, and so we were at, I was at the service, and they were supposed to be announcing the who's in the hall that day, and so. I was just still into the service, and as soon as it's over with, I got in my car, and I was in Little Rock, and I drove out in the country, and drove around by myself, and we didn't have a phone, didn't have anything, and so I finally came back into town and drove up, to my daughter's house. and she was outside, and so sure that was her husband that had just died, and when I drove up in front, they were outside. She was outside, and she was smiling. So I figured that something good had happened, just because she had been through so much. So, but anyway, that's how I found out from her when I came up to her house.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I didn't know.
Yeah.
Hopefully by the time the ceremony rolled around, you were able to appreciate everything that you had accomplished on the football field.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think about that sort of thing so much. I just try to be appreciative of that honor. And I know that there's so many others that tried just as hard as I did. But time again, situation dictated that, the position I was in at the time and the way that we played it, it was a little bit different. And I was at the area, I was in that time where we were making a transition in that position at the tight end. And so I think that if I did anything, I helped facilitate that transition from being strictly a blocker to making the tight end a somewhat important and effective receiver.
1994 is the Hall of Fame. 2009 is the St. Louis Hall of Fame. What the heck took those guys so long to figure it out?
Well, I don't know if it was St. Louis. I think that St. Louis was put together really by an individual. And I think that they put that in. I don't know if even that organization was formed until.
Gotcha.
Until, in fact, I think we were the first one.
Okay, now that makes sense.
Yeah, to go into the
well deserved.
Into the St. Louis Hall of Fame, yeah. But because I think that was really not that was something that was formed a little bit after I got in.
You and Jerry, proud parents of four children.
Yep.
And it looks like they're all doing crazy good stuff.
Yeah, he is. I'm really proud of him very much, as I am all of them. But, yeah, he's taken on a lot. He's taken on a lot, and he's surviving, and he's doing better, and he's making it work.
How many grandkids?
14.
Is that as much fun as they say?
It's more. You can't describe it, yeah. Very much fun.
When they all come over, is there a routine? Is there something that you guys really like to do as a family? Because that's a lot of kids.
Yeah, well, it looks like the Wild Indian daycare center at times, but we don't get to see all of them at one time. They come in spurts. So they're evenly dispersed and adequately dispersed. So we enjoy them all the time.
You made St. Louis your home.
Yeah.
Glad you did.
Of course. We get, as far as my children are concerned, and, to move back and forth back down to Louisiana or whatever, to move out of the area, we did that for a couple of years, and it just didn't make any sense to have to make so much change for a part of a for a whole almost a whole year, well, 6 months of the year practically, to be able to accommodate football. So yeah, what the heck? So we just sold a home in Baton Rouge and got everybody up here. Somebody up here, and now these my kids don't know anything about Louisiana. Except that the grandma and grandpa were down there for a long time, but other than that, we just don't. We don't. They don't go down there. Have never been down there. Have no reason to go there, but we do, and we go back periodically.
Well, I'm glad that you took the time. I really appreciate it. Hopefully, you had a good time.
Well, I had a great time. Thank you very much.
AmericasWall.com. Look into it, guys. And there you have it, the great Jackie Smith. Thanks for sharing and liking on Facebook and on Twitter. And if you got any suggestions for upcoming episodes, email is otwitholiver@gmail.com. Speaking of the next episode, going to do something a little different this week on Thursday. We're not going to wait till Sunday. This week on Thursday, had an opportunity to sit down with the good folks at Earth Dance Organic Farm School. It's out in Ferguson. If you haven't checked it out, you need to. And during the episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the importance of growing local during these times and other things that are timely. So as we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.